You're listening to TIP.
I worked at T. Rowe Price out of Harvard Business School, and T. Rowe is a fantastic firm. There, I was only covering kind of a few industries, so I wasn't a generalist like I am today. And I was probably covering 30 to 40 companies in those industries where I was kind of tasked with kind of being, you know, the expert on these companies. Contrast that with what I was doing in my personal account, which, you know, at any period of time, I probably had 10 or 12 investments that I thought were really going to be exceptional. And that always felt fine. And I would say, look, you know, with a lot of investing, there are many ways to make money. There is no, you know, kind of one right answer. But I think a lot of investing is kind of a personal journey to figure out, you know, what makes the most sense for each of us.
In today's episode, I chat with Jeremy Cokemore, the founder of Righttail Capital. Since its inception in May of 2022, Righttail's net performance is 22.5% for performance fee investors, 25.5% for management fee investors, and 21.7% for the S&P 500. Jeremy Cokemore is an investor that I find very interesting because he does many things different than the industry. For one thing, he uses Buffett's 0-6-25 model, which is incredibly rare. He's put a lot of time and effort into aligning himself with his partners as much as he possibly can. In this conversation, he'll detail many of the ideas that he's implemented in his fund to help ensure that he has skin in the game. Additionally, he's not a closet indexer, holding a concentrated portfolio of very high quality businesses. We discuss a lot of interesting tidbits on investing, such as why value, growth, and quality are all important for successful investing, why price isn't the only way to get a margin of safety, why investors should look at reinvestment rates to help identify wonderful investments, why you should only invest in countries that have shareholder-friendly regulations, and how many investments per year concentrated investors need to be successful. If you like Buffett, meaning investing in high-quality businesses, concentrating your positions, and thinking long-term, you're going to love this episode. Now, without further delay, let's jump right into this week's episode with Jeremy Cokemore.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we interviewed successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation. Now for your host, Kyle Grieve.
Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Grieve, and today we bring Jeremy Cokemore onto the podcast. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
So Jeremy is the Chief Investment Officer of Righttail Capital. And one of the coolest things that I came across when researching you was your fee structure. I've always loved Buffett's 0-6-25 fee structure that you've adopted. Can you break down the fee structure in a little more detail and discuss why you think this is the optimal way to align yourself with your partners?
So I remember hearing about this fee structure years ago, and it always just kind of jumped out to me as something that is unique and could potentially create quite a bit of alignment. So first, you know, what the fee structure is exactly what you said. So there is no management fee. As you know, in the investment management industry, management fees are pretty common. And so the only way that Righttail will generate a fee under this structure is to have positive performance, and that performance needs to be over 6% per year. And if it is over 6% a year, then Righttail's fee ends up being 25% of whatever performance is above 6%. So, you know, for instance, if the returns in a year were 10%, you would just do a simple 10 minus 6 is 4 times 25%, and the fee to Righttail would be 1%. Now, you mentioned the concept of alignment and also the concept of fee structures. And in my opinion, there isn't really a perfect fee structure. You know, I'm a big fan of Morgan Housel and his book, The Psychology of Money. And he does a great job of describing how we all have very different feelings and histories towards money. And it's probably, you know, just decades of, you know, what did our parents teach us and our grandparents, and what did we grow up with and not grow up with? And so I'm very just cognizant that I'm not going to be able to create the perfect fee structure, And I don't think that a fee structure is the only way to create alignment. So there are several ways that I've tried to create great alignment at Rightail. You know, one is just my wife and I continue to be the largest investors at Rightail, both in terms of the dollar amount and likely will always be the number one investor in terms of percentage of our net worth. So for me, that's like a really important way that I'm aligned with all of my investors. But then it also gets into like just simple day-to-day habits of, you know, I want to be in the best frame of mind, making the best long-term decisions for our investors. And so whether it's things like physical exercise or meditating, just things that help me be a little bit better and in a better frame of mind day-to-day, I think all those things help create great alignment. But you're right. The fee structure is one that I hope creates some great alignment with everyone.
Yeah, I really like those intangible ways that you've created an ability to be partnered, truly partnered with your partners. But I'm interested in knowing, so I look for people using your fee structure and you know, I can probably name the amount of people that I know of that do it on one hand. So it's not very popular. So I'm interested in knowing why you think this is such a kind of rare way to structure a fund.
I know you're a big fan of Modus Fabrae, Kyle, and I remember hearing him speak once years ago on a podcast and just talking about how he used the same fee structure and how he has positively cloned, you know, a lot of the great things that he's learned from Buffett and Munger. And, you know, he was talking about the fee structure. And I remember him saying something along the lines of, well, I tell everyone who's thinking about starting an investment firm to use this fee structure and it creates good alignment. And if you do it, good things will come over time. Like it may be hard to think of not having a management fee, but good things will happen over time. And then he goes on to say, no one ends up doing it. And having lived, you know, through having this fee structure for the last almost 2 years, I would surmise that maybe people don't do it very often because it is hard, you know, to not have a steady stream of income. And for most folks who decide to start an investment firm, they likely have done a good job at investing and there's something that has given them confidence and hopefully there's a deep passion there as well to want to go out and kind of share their investing talents with other folks. But a lot of us have not run a business before, and a lot of us have probably had some, maybe a lot of success in our past lives, both in investing and, you know, in our school studies and things like that. And so, you know, for me, where day one, I was managing maybe $3 or $4 million and had 3 or 4 investors, there are some challenges and it takes a little bit of a rewiring to go from being paid well and having sort of a steady salary and a year-end bonus to kind of saying, well, you know, I'm not really going to get paid at all for the time being. And it really is going to be based on performance. So I would guess that one of the reasons that people don't do it is because it's just kind of very hard to stomach that. And then secondarily, I've seen a lot of folks who have started investment businesses who have invested a lot in the business. Either they've built a big team up front or they get the shiny office space in Midtown Manhattan, wherever it might be. And that can create a certain amount of pressure as well. And it may even create so much pressure that it changes your investment outlook or it changes how long term you can really think. And, you know, so I was like, look, I don't want to do any of that. I want to keep expenses low. I can, you know, hopefully do the best job possible within the framework of this fee structure and create as much alignment as possible. But that would be my one guess as to why maybe more people don't do it.
So I know you actually do have a fee only option for your services as well. What made you want to add this feature to your services?
Sure. It goes back to a bit of what we were discussing with just, you know, kind of each individual maybe having different preferences regarding money and investing. And a really close friend of mine who works at an endowment I remember years ago, he was saying, hey, you know, you might just want to offer investors a choice, you know, like people might appreciate that. And so what I tried to do was to come up with a fair management fee only option that would hopefully have the two structures be, you know, relatively equivalent. And so what I kind of came up with was a 1.25% management fee. And so the break even between the two structures in any single year would be 11%. And there have been some interesting takeaways and surprises of kind of offering the choice. You know, one, I would say my ability to predict what someone might choose is near zero. So that's been, you know, that's been kind of fun and just kind of interesting to see. And then another thing that has surprised me is just, you know, that where I sit today, and I'm fortunate to have, you know, 46 long-term like-minded investors who, you know, have invested alongside me, and we're roughly 50% in one fee structure, 50% in the other fee structure. So hopefully that lends some credence to maybe the structures are relatively comparable. And then I really just want each investor to pick the one that will make them happiest in however they kind of think about things.
You alluded earlier that, you know, that with your fee structure, you can't have a cushy corner office in Midtown Manhattan, whereas some of these more AUM-based fee structure companies, they can afford that because they have a lot of money coming in, and that's just the way they run their business. But with the way you run yours, what kind of general differences do you see between the way you run your fund and, you know, some of these more AUM-based fee structures?
Well, I can certainly speak about how I do it, Kyle. And in general, I just try to be very thoughtful around, you know, where I would like to, you know, allocate investment dollars or expenses. And it all kind of works well for me, and I believe gives me the best odds of, you know, showing great long-term investment performance. So, you know, for the time being, I have a home office and I really enjoy working from home. You know, as you know, a lot of what I do on a day-to-day basis is reading and thinking. So, you know, I kind of need a quiet, comfortable space, and working from home works really well for me. And I was very fortunate to have, you know, some experience working from home, largely due to COVID, because before that, I wouldn't have guessed that, you know, I could be as productive working from home. So that, you know, that would be one thing that I would mention as maybe something where I could see, you know, potentially having an office or some shared office space or something in the future. But I love my current setup. And then when I think about where I do want to kind of allocate expenses, it's really with, you know, kind of my investors' thoughts in mind. And it's, you know, being thoughtful about different research services I subscribe to and things of that nature. But I have everything I need. So, you know, I feel like it's set up well. And I often think about, you know, Buffett has a great line about, you know, more about when he's analyzing two businesses in the same industry. And, you know, he'll kind of say, well, gosh, like one might have a cost structure that's like 50% of the other companies in the industry. And we might all say they're in the same industry. And Buffett makes the point that no, they're actually like two very, very different businesses. And why that's important when, you know, folks, you know, think about Rightail, or when I do, is just that I've set the business up to just give myself incredible long-term investment duration and staying power. And so, you know, a lot of these, you know, little decisions, you know, end up being very important.
So you mentioned in a previous interview that you aren't a fan of putting yourself into a value or growth bucket. So I tend to agree with you on this, as, you know, value and growth are both important to success in investing. And, you know, you can get value in both high and low growth businesses, just as you could overpay in both high and low growth businesses. So I'm interested in just understanding a little bit more about how you factor this into the types of investments that you make.
You know, it's funny. I think about all the investment management interviews I've done over the years, and, you know, some of them I would get asked pretty often, you know, what type of investor are you? Are you value or growth? And I didn't really have a great answer at the time. I knew that I was like very uncomfortable every time that question was asked, you know, because in my mind, I was thinking, one, I'm pretty flexible, but, you know, aren't we all just trying to find like good investments, you know, that are going to, you know, make money over time? And so, yeah, you know, and Buffett has talked a lot in his letters about both value and growth being very important to how you would even, you know, potentially think about valuing a business or considering an investment. In super simple terms, you know, I really want to find an above average quality business and buy it at a fair to below average price. That's all I'm trying to do, you know, in simple terms. And we can get into, you know, more details around how I think about that. If I have to pick one over the other, I care more about the quality side than the price side. But, you know, I always want to be thoughtful to each situation that I see. But in general, I want to find high quality businesses and allow them to continue to create value for Rightail and for us shareholders over many years at a time.
And so you mentioned there that you like buying at a price that's, you know, hopefully at or below the price of the market. So I'm interested in knowing how you mitigate risk by using the price that you pay for a business.
I love a lower price, and I've had many colleagues over the years who might define themselves as like a more traditional value investor, which I would define as, you know, maybe a low price to earnings multiple or some sort of near-term valuation metric that is jumping off the page as being low. And so I've mostly kind of learned and been fortunate to work with folks like that. And so I love a lower price. There's nothing wrong with that at all. Would love to find a fantastic business at a very cheap multiple. But again, I just really focus on, you know, paying a fair, and hopefully it ends up being kind of a below average price for each great business. I also think there's a lot of margin of safety. You know, the price that you pay is one, you know, sort of factor of margin of safety. Another, I think, is the quality of the business. So a lot of the businesses that I own, Kyle, have great balance sheets. They have great management teams, and they have certain competitive advantages. And oftentimes these businesses, because of how they structured themselves and because they're not so worried about how they're going to pay off their debt and things of that nature, that when tough times do come for the economy or that industry specifically, a lot of times these companies can actually play more offense than their peers can. And that's exactly what I think we should be rooting for, you know, as long-term investors. And so what I've kind of found is, you know, a lot of times there's a great margin of safety in, you know, just having these awesome businesses that will figure out ways to win and gain market share when everyone else maybe is playing with one hand tied behind their back or something like that.
So I think most investors have a few general principles when it comes to their core philosophy. You already kind of shared that you obviously place a massive emphasis on quality. But so for instance, someone like Chuck Acree, you know, he has his three-legged stool, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is buy extraordinary businesses with talented management, with great reinvestment opportunities and histories. So I'm just interested in knowing, you know, outside of quality, what is kind of the essence of your investing philosophy?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, Kyle. That is a lot of it. When I think about quality, I think about a couple of things. So one, quantitatively, the two things that I care a lot about are how long is the company's reinvestment runway? And then secondly, what incremental rates of return can a company invest their capital? So the companies we invest in, they're producing cash flow each year, and then they can decide what they want to do with their cash flow. And I want to find the companies that can invest that capital thoughtfully and intelligently and have it produce even more, you know, capital and cash flow for us. And, you know, if that happens, you know, we'll end up creating a lot more value that way. So again, quantitatively, I care about the reinvestment runway. I care about the returns on incremental capital. Now, there's a lot that goes into that qualitatively, but, you know, a simple way to frame it would be to say, you know, that, you know, I want to invest in companies that have sustainable competitive advantages or some sort of moat that allows them to generate these high incremental rates of return. Because as we all know, you know, we live in, you know, a capitalist economy, and whenever there are good rates of return, that is probably going to attract, you know, more capital and more competitors. And so it really does, there need to be things that are special that allow, you know, these positive characteristics to exist and to exist for many years in the future.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, the Range Rover Sport leads by example. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capability, and combines assertive on-road performance with the signature Range Rover refinement that you'd expect. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, and redefines sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, which offer new levels of comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-like driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can also enjoy a dynamic drive in total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com. Hey guys, about a year and a half ago, my wife and I got married, and one of the most stressful parts of our relationship has been trying to join our finances together. We all know that money issues are a leading cause of divorce, but Monarch, the top-rated personal finance app, has built-in collaboration features so that you can invite your partner at no extra cost. Together, you can see all your finances, collaborate on your budget, and get insights on your cash flow and recurring transactions. It's the easiest way to manage your household finances. Unlike other personal finance apps that we tried, Monarch's simple, intuitive design makes it so easy to set up, customize, and use. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product, and they release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. Most importantly, they never sell your data to third parties or show you ads. After trying out Monarch for myself, my wife and I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners on this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/MI. That's MONARCHMONEY.com/MI for your extended 30-day free trial. Go to monarchmoney.com/MI for an extended 30-day free trial.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% in APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. All right, back to the show. So I know that you own two investments that are both excellent performing stocks and great businesses, but go about allocating capital in slightly different ways, which you kind of just discussed. So these two names are O'Reilly Auto Parts and NVR. So I'm interested in knowing, how do you forecast the future fundamental developments of these businesses in terms of growth and capital allocation?
In some ways, I would say that O'Reilly and NVR have a lot of similarities. So, you know, they're both companies that I've found to be very much kind of long-term thinkers, you know, in terms of how they plan, in terms of how they allocate capital. Both companies tend to have employees who have been at these companies for very long periods of time. And we could maybe guess like some reasons why that might be. One is they both have a history of success, you know? So it's probably a bit of a fun environment to be in when you work at a company that's been very successful. O'Reilly is kind of interesting because, you know, they're based in Missouri and, you know, so maybe they have certain advantages just based on where they are, but they've done an awesome job. Their new CEO, you know, is someone who is young and has a lot of energy. And I believe his first job at O'Reilly was right out of high school, you know, basically helping to unload some of the trucks. NVR is, you know, headquartered, you know, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours north of where I live in Richmond, Virginia, and has a big presence in the area. And so I've been fortunate to meet longer tenured employees who work at NVR, and kind of same thing there. You know, there are certain things that NVR does from a compensation standpoint, like they tend to issue options every 4 years. And so just in terms of, you know, having these options that vest over a longer period of time, I think that perhaps creates a bit of long-term thinking as well. So those are maybe some of the things they have in common. You're right. I would say they allocate capital a little bit differently. O'Reilly, you know, O'Reilly is often building new stores or investing in their distribution capabilities. And if we were to look at their financials and look at the last 10 or 15 years, their returns on incremental capital have been phenomenal. I used to think of that industry as one where O'Reilly and AutoZone and Advance Auto Parts as the three bigger players. I used to think of it as they were all kind of slowly gaining share from the mom and pops who maybe have less scale, or maybe they could carry less inventory during a challenging period like COVID when supply chains were disrupted. The mom and pops likely have less advantageous financing terms and things like that. But, you know, more recently things have changed where, you know, Advance has likely had some challenges for a long period of time and has been a more acquisitive company. And now it looks like O'Reilly is gaining share in a big way from Advance, and probably even, you know, maybe gaining some share from AutoZone as well, which is also kind of a well-managed and really great company. To segue a bit to NVR, you know, so it's funny, both of the companies repurchase a lot of shares. Both of the companies have done very few acquisitions, although with O'Reilly, you could point to some. You know, there was one that they did about 15 years ago that ended up being a home run, but these aren't companies that are doing acquisitions every year. And NVR is just very thoughtful around, you know, they kind of came up with a different model about 30 years ago after almost going bankrupt during the savings and loan crisis. And they ended up feeling like owning the land that they build their homes on was kind of the riskiest part of the capital allocation, you know, framework for a home builder. So they said, you know, hey, we're not going to own the land anymore. What we're going to do is work with local land developers, and we'll buy an option to build on the lots that they develop. And they end up probably paying a slightly higher price for these options, but the flexibility that it gives them, you know, kind of far surpasses, you know, whatever little bit they kind of give up in the near term. And they have just done a fantastic job over the last 30 years. It's been an amazing investment. I've been fortunate to be an NVR investor for much of the last 6 years. With O'Reilly, it's been kind of much of the last 4 years. So even predating Rightail, these are companies that I've been studying for a long time. I'm happy to go into any more detail about those companies or how they allocate capital, but that's a bit of a summary.
Yeah, I would love to know more about, especially NVR, because NVR and is kind of the poster child for, you know, for share buybacks and creating tremendous shareholder value through share buybacks. So would you maybe be able to go through that in a little more detail for the audience?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. One of the things that is funny is, so NVR gets grouped with all the other home builders. And it was a bit like the Buffett quote that we talked about earlier. They do look a lot like other home builders. They build homes, but their businesses are structured very differently. And so NVR just has a lot less capital tied up on their balance sheet. And I've learned over time too, that while I think most investors associate NVR with this lack of land ownership and this asset light strategy, there are many, many little things that I think NVR does really well. And it helps them to kind of turn their inventory of lots faster. They come through on their commitments to the land developers. So I've talked to land developers who are like, look, I've worked with all the big guys, including NVR, and NVR always does an amazing job of kind of doing what they say they're going to do. And so I don't mind having a bigger portion of my business with them because I know they're going to get it done on time. It helps me plan my business. And I bring all this up to say that a lot of times when I see sell side analysts talk about the home building industry, they'll often make a relative value comparison and say, well, gosh, like the other home builders trade at 1x book value, or they trade at 6 to 8x earnings. And then you look at NVR and the multiples that it trades at are much, much higher. Okay, so that's one point. Second point would be, well, we could look at NVR's stock price performance over pretty much any period of time over the last 30 years. And even if you said, well, gosh, it's not fair to look at some of those early years where they were going through a business model change and there was a lot of risk and the investment community couldn't understand it. Well, you know, I would say, well, it's been very clear, you know, for a good portion of that time, maybe at least the last 20 years. And the NVR stock price performance has just been phenomenal. So we have this issue where the valuation looks optically higher, but the stock price performance has also been really, really amazing. So, you know, I would say the market has never really had the valuation correct for NVR. And it's a business that, you know, historically has had returns on invested capital well north of 30%. And even though it's traded at a big premium to the other home builders, it has still, during most of that time, largely traded at a discount to kind of the average company in the S&P 500 business. And I would say it's a well, well above average company than most of the companies in the S&P 500. And albeit it can be cyclical, right? When we came out of the great financial crisis, it was a slow, there were less homes being sold because we just had too much inventory. So we do need to be, you know, kind of thoughtful around the cycles. But putting that aside for a second, NVR has taken all this cash flow and has just rebought or just repurchased many, many shares over time. And I won't get the number exactly right, but I think today NVR has maybe like somewhere around 3.5 million shares outstanding, which is just an absurdly low number, you know? And it's one of the reasons, of course, they could have chosen to split the stock or something at some point, but, you know, it's one of these unique stocks that has a really high share price, around $7,000 a share, but that share count is about as low as I could think of for kind of a decently sized publicly traded company. And you're right, they've created a lot of value by just repurchasing their shares over a long period of time.
I know you're a fellow fan of concentrated portfolios like myself, so I'm always interested in learning more about investors' past and kind of why they settled on concentrated portfolios, because, you know, it's not something that you necessarily learn in school. I mean, it's kind of something that you learn just from studying the greats yourself, I guess. So I'm interested in just knowing, you know, why was it that you settled on a portfolio, a concentrated portfolio of, say, 8 to 15 names that you're at now?
You're right. We typically don't learn this at school. You know, we normally learn about the benefits of diversification. And it's interesting because most of the literature I've read, you know, suggests that a lot of the benefits of diversification, especially if you're not investing in, you know, the same business across all the stocks, but you get a lot of the benefits of diversification once you know, kind of hit 10 stocks or something around that. So that's one thing that I find interesting. But concentrated investing has always just felt very natural to me. it took me a while to be able to articulate that. But what I kind of noticed over time was, you know, for example, I worked at T. Rowe Price out of Harvard Business School, and T. Rowe is a fantastic firm. There, I was only covering kind of a few industries, so I wasn't a generalist like I am today. And I was probably covering 30 to 40 companies in those industries where I was kind of tasked with kind of being, you know, the expert on these companies. Contrast that with what I was doing in my personal account, which, you know, at any period of time, I probably had 10 or 12 investments that I thought were really going to be exceptional. And that always felt fine. And I would say, look, you know, with a lot of investing, there are many ways to make money. There is no, you know, kind of one right answer. But I think a lot of investing is kind of a personal journey to figure out, you know, what makes the most sense for each of us. And so, you know, somewhere in that 8 to 15 range is the sweet spot for me. And today at Rightail, I own, you know, 13 different positions. And it's fantastic. You know, it allows me to concentrate my time on these names. When I find a new name, which I'm sure we'll spend some time talking about, you know, I can compare it to the 13 I already have and try to find a new investment that will come in, you know, well above what I think the return potential of the average holding could be within that 13. And then when those investments do well, one of the benefits of a concentrated portfolio is that it can have a really punchy, impactful performance on the returns. And also, no position is so big that I'm losing sleep about it at night, or that when something goes wrong, because things will inevitably go wrong with some of these investments, will have an impact on the portfolio, but it'll have like a modest impact. And then if we think really long-term, I would expect that, you know, it'll probably be more like a handful of these investments, or maybe even a slightly lower number, that will really have just the dramatic positive impact on the portfolio. So on the downside, if I have an 8% position and it, you know, it goes down 25% and we lose 200 basis points or 2% of performance, that may not be fun in the short term, but I think when we're looking back on it 10 years from now, you know, we'll probably be talking about the companies that have grown to be multiples of the original value that we invested. And those will have a much bigger impact on kind of the overall return profile.
A question I'm fond of asking professional investors like yourself is how they prefer to enter positions. Do you like taking, you know, smaller positions to start and then adding as you gain more and more conviction and knowledge of a business? Or are you, you know, just kind of piling money in as fast as possible to get to your desired, you know, let's say 8% position size?
For me, it's situation dependent based on a few factors. One is, you know, I would say prior knowledge of the business and industry. So if it's a business that I really feel like I know well, or maybe I've invested in it in the past, you know, that would maybe make me a little bit more comfortable in terms of making it a slightly larger position up front. So that would be one factor. The second factor would be, you know, just how great of an investment do I think it might be? If it looks incremental to the portfolio, and like I said, you know, trying to find ones that are not better than the 13th position in the portfolio, but hopefully kind of more in the top half, which is kind of another way that I think about, you know, kind of margin of safety and avoiding incremental sinking. But if it really looks exceptional, that might argue for a larger position as well. But I've learned over time that no matter how much work I do upfront on a business and the industry that it's in and its peers, there are always things that I kind of overestimate or underestimate. And I learn more as I own the business and as I get, you know, kind of more reps with the company and just kind of understanding what they do. And so, you know, that is something that over time where I've kind of said, you know, hey, I'm open to starting off at the larger position, but a lot of times, you know, I may just start with, you know, something that's maybe around a 5% position where, you know, it's still a reasonably sized position, And over time, if things kind of unfold positively and most of the things that I thought going in kind of play out, I'm totally fine, you know, kind of adding to the position, even if it's gone up a little bit, provided that I think the long-term opportunity continues to be there for exceptional returns.
So I'm also interested in knowing, what is the desired market cap, let's say, of your dream business?
I'm very flexible when it comes to market cap. But if I really were to say kind of the dream business, and I would hope that when you and I are talking again in 10 years, I would hope that I've found an extra one or two smaller businesses to invest in. And if I can do that, and I think I'll be able to over time, if I can do that, then, you know, who knows? Like, A, that could imply that there's a longer reinvestment runway. If it's a smaller business, it may be kind of less well known, less discovered, and trade at, you know, a less expensive valuation. That would be attractive too. So those are kind of all the positives. But I also go in with a fair amount of skepticism around smaller companies as well. Some companies are small and they, you know, they tell an interesting investment story, but, you know, you look at the history and they've been small for a really, really long time, you know, and old habits and industry structures and things, those are hard to change, not to say that they can't. When I'm going through and doing the analysis, I do want to be able to study the history of the business and how the returns on capital have kind of evolved over time. And sometimes, not always, sometimes there's a bit more history and it's a bit easier to study for a business that's slightly larger. So I would say, you know, I really am very open-minded and I don't mind investing in larger businesses that can still compound at, you know, kind of a mid-teens or higher rate of return over kind of a multiple year period. That being said, I'm hopeful, you know, as we talk in many years' time, that I'll have found, you know, one or two additional smaller companies that might have all the benefits of those larger companies, but maybe even have a longer reinvestment runway and higher return potential.
And so just for the audience, what would you consider? Because, you know, different people have different definitions, but what would you consider a small company in terms of market cap?
My smallest investment today is probably around $5 billion of market cap. So I would probably put a range on it of, you know, maybe $500 million to $5 billion in market cap, something like that.
So depending on the levels of turnover that a portfolio manager has, they may have a great year making, you know, zero investments, or they may consider it a great year making dozens and dozens of investments. So you're obviously concentrated, so I can kind of guess where the answer is going to be here. But how many new investments do you try to add per year, and what would a perfect year look like?
I underwrite each position over a potential three-year holding period. If we were just to say, hey, what's 12 or 15 or whatever number of investments in the portfolio divided by three or something along those lines, it would kind of suggest that, you know, maybe in a given year, there are only a couple of new investments. So I often kind of describe it as, you know, kind of saying, hey, I think it's probably 0 to 3 new investments per year. I recently made a new investment, but prior to that, I really hadn't made one in about a year. So that's just one example from a very small, you know, kind of sample of time. But the goal is really not to have a specific number of new investments a year. One, I would say the goal is really to just get more knowledgeable on different businesses and different industries. And each year that goes by, to be able to share with you, hey, these are the industries where I feel like I've learned a lot over the last year. And that may be helpful for a new investment. It may be helpful for a current investment where I, you know, learned something or about some type of idea that I could apply to the rest of the portfolio. Or it may be some learning that really comes to fruition in several years of time when, you know, maybe a new opportunity comes up or the price drops a lot, whatever the case might be. There are a lot of ways that I think kind of building that library and knowing more industries, you know, in a more knowledgeable way can just really, really benefit over time. The other thing I'd say about the topic of turnover is, you know, when I look back over my career, some of the times that have been most fruitful for finding new investments is when there are kind of a lot of challenges and kind of weaker performance in the market. The early period when COVID kind of, you know, first happened in kind of, you know, early 2020, that really just kind of created some amazing investment opportunities where, you know, there was a great business and a great management team and a great balance sheet. And all of a sudden, you know, for whatever reason, the stock was down 50%. And if you could, you know, get some level of conviction that the business had enough cash to survive a very challenging period of time, and that their competitive advantages were going to be at least as strong or maybe, you know, even get stronger, that, you know, an example like that or that type of period where there's a lot of dislocation, there might be even, you know, more turnover because you just have this very rare opportunity to really upgrade the return potential of the portfolio. Those are rare, but they absolutely happen. And, you know, I want to be, you know, kind of ready and willing and knowledgeable enough to act when those opportunities come up.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, the Range Rover Sport leads by example. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capability, and combines assertive on-road performance with the signature Range Rover refinement that you'd expect. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, and redefines sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, which offer new levels of comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-like driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can also enjoy a dynamic drive in total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. All right, back to the show. I wanted to move on to evaluation because you have some interesting evaluation methods that I wanted to go into. So you mentioned that you'll break down the internal rates of return of a potential investment using some simple bond math. So I'm interested, can you please detail this evaluation method for the audience?
Sure. And feel free to ask any questions if I get a little too in the weeds or I'm not describing it well. But simply, we're always trying to figure out what cash flows an investment is going to produce over its lifetime and then kind of value those cash flows. And one way to do that is to try to think about owning an equity like you might think about a bond. And so, you know, the way owning an equity can be similar to a bond is if you say, all right, well, what is the coupon payment that the bond kind of pays to the owner each year or a couple times a year? And so I would say that's very similar to the cash earnings that the stock or the company generates. So the cash earnings yield for the business. And then the second component would be, okay, well, for a company, those earnings might grow over time. So what's the current cash earnings yield? And then how might we evaluate the future growth? So that would be to like just keep it simple and think of it in two ways. And then we can further break down that growth component, which I think is a really fun thing to think through. And so that growth component, I would say we could break down into two factors as well. The first factor would be growth that the company can achieve without reinvestment. And so good examples of that type of growth would be something like Moody's bond rating business, where they have this dominant position in the market. There's probably going to be a little bit of volume growth in the market over time. Maybe it's 1-3%. And because they're so dominant and because, you know, having a rating from Moody's or S&P helps lower the interest rate that an issuer of debt might achieve, well, they could raise the price a little bit each year because it's still kind of a great value for the issuer of the bond. You know, Moody's, they'll grow a little bit without arguably really needing to reinvest. Another example would be Visa and MasterCard, where they've grown for a long time, just as so much of the world's payment has shifted from cash to credit cards, and they have the credit card networks. That's the first component of growth. The second component of growth, some companies have both, some have one or the other, some have neither. But the second component is the reinvestment component. And so there, what I try to do is say, how much can this company reinvest each year? And at what rate of return can they reinvest? So to use some simple math, let's say a company could reinvest $100 at a 20% rate of return. So you'd multiply those two numbers together, you'd come out with $20. So that's effectively $20 of new earnings. And then you could capitalize that new earning stream that is hopefully being created each year by the company's reinvestment and capitalize that at some earnings multiple. So to wrap it all up, I would say, you know, you can look at this bond math and kind of say, all right, cash earnings yield plus growth without reinvestment plus growth from reinvestment. And I add those up and I get to a potential IRR for the investment. And that's one way I like to look at valuation. And it has been very beneficial for me, particularly thinking through the growth components and especially that reinvestment component, because I think that is a piece of the analysis that often gets lost when investors are just talking about, well, company A trades at a 15 times PE and company B trades at a 20 times PE. And when you really try to go through some of the reinvestment math, it just kind of shows how great companies, even if they may look to be a little bit more expensively valued, can still be the better investment over many years.
I love that point. Chris Mayer was telling me specifically about that, how, you know, you can look at two businesses in the same industry that maybe are competitors, and one might be just extravagantly priced on, like, you know, PE, price to earnings or whatever. But when you look at the ability to reinvest at high rates, it makes a huge difference. And, you know, you can pay optically a much higher PE multiple for one business, and it could still be, you know, the better deal than paying for the cheaper one.
It's a fantastic point, and it's a lesson that I learned so many times over the years and learned it the hard way, where it's often easier, I think, especially when we're, you know, first exposed to investing, where if you're maybe studying three companies in the industry, well, you know, why wouldn't you want to invest in the one that trades at a cheaper valuation? And especially if that one that, you know, is at a cheaper valuation, especially if there is a new management team or they're trying some new procedures that are going to help them close the gap to where that number one player is. And so you can look at one of those companies and, you know, come up with a case of, wow, well, their earnings are really going to improve and maybe the valuation will improve too. And that'll be fantastic. And what I kind of consistently saw over time, and obviously there are exceptions, but sometimes I'd come back a few years later and I'd look at that industry again and I'd say, well, gosh, that company that I thought was the best, it's still the best. It still appears to trade at a more expensive valuation. And it's been the best stock performance of the three companies. And, you know, so after, you know, making that mistake and learning that lesson several times, you know, it was just a great learning and one that, you know, fits with who I am, you know, as a person, and just the same way that I want to try to continue to get better and have lots of good habits and disciplines that help me do that. I typically want to invest in companies that are very consistent and do a lot of little things well. And going through this bond math that I just described is one way to, you know, help put some numbers around something that can be very hard, which is like kind of a quality, you know, it might be easy to say, well, this is the best company in the industry. But it's not always easy to say, okay, well, this is actually why, based on the numbers, it might end up being the best investment. And that's one thing that's very important for me to try to think through.
You've also mentioned that you do have a couple of other evaluation criteria that you use in just kind of discounted cash flow and using just multiples. You know, you don't have to go too into deep depth into these, but I'm just interested, are you using all three of these kind of in conjunction to make sure that your evaluation is kind of directionally correct? Or, you know, do you weight one higher than others? I'm interested in knowing more about that.
Absolutely. I think through all of them. For me, one of the areas of thinking through that bond math example where I get uncomfortable is if the multiple is too high, if the current multiple is too high or the cash earnings yield is too low. And so maybe there's an example, like if we think of a lot of software businesses a couple of years ago when they were trading at 30 times sales, and you could argue that they were cash flow positive and they were just kind of investing the cash flow through the income statement. But, you know, they're trading at these really, really high valuations. And so someone, I think, could look at some of this investment math and say, well, they are reinvesting at high rates of return and the industry that they're in is growing. And so don't worry about the cash earnings yield not being there. It could still be a good IRR. And so thinking through the current multiples or also putting the numbers through a DCF, it will probably make a potential investment like the one I just described. It'll be a good gut check that might say, well, gosh, like it looks like it's going to be really hard to make money with this type of investment. So there's no kind of, I wouldn't say I use, you know, each of the different methods as a certain percentage of the decision, because there's so much that goes into it. I need to feel like the company is high quality and is sustainable and hopefully improving over time. But I do like to think through those different methods as, you know, just kind of a bit of a soundness check to say, you know, kind of, does this seem reasonable? And, you know, if so, if more of them line up, then, you know, there might be a slightly higher chance that, you know, the investment ends up making it into the portfolio.
So in an interview from March of 2023, you said that all your investments were in North America, most in the US, with one being in Canada. So I'm just interested, is this a circle of competence thing, or are you willing to eventually invest abroad once you, you know, if you know that the country that you're investing in has regulations that are supportive of shareholders?
That last thing you said, Kyle, is incredibly important. I want to make sure that I understand the rule of law in any place that I would invest. And, you know, the US is one area where, you know, I feel like we do have really good laws, and, you know, it's a place where entrepreneurship is encouraged and intellectual property is largely protected. And those are kind of fertile ingredients that, you know, can lead to good kind of economic value creation over time. So you're right. Today, I have investments in the US and Canada. I feel like I have a good understanding of those places. I'm open-minded to investing in other geographies, but I would need to feel like I, you know, had a pretty good understanding that the country was more similar to the US than different. So is it possible that, Rightail, we could end up owning business based in the UK or, you know, somewhere in Europe where, you know, I feel like we really understood things. Yes, I think that's definitely possible. I would say what's probably less likely would be, you know, to invest, you know, in an emerging market where, rightly so, there might be better potential for longer term growth. But if I don't understand kind of the rules that we're playing by, to me, it's just easier to kind of avoid what I don't understand because there are so many great opportunities in the places that I do understand.
So you noted in a previous interview that you tend to stay away from biotech, and I'm 100% on the same page as you here. But I'm interested in knowing some other areas of the market that you've just flat out refused to invest in, and briefly describe why that is.
In biotech, it's fairly simple. You know, I think understanding the science can be really important for a lot of biotech investments. And I've been fortunate to work with other biotech investors who, you know, are trained MDs, you know, who've gone through medical school, understand the science, and I think can do a darn good job of saying, well, hey, you know, the market seems to price in a 20% chance that this drug will get approved or whatever the case might be. And I actually think it's like 50%. And, you know, if I have a bunch of these small bets where I think the odds are really aligned in our favor, then, you know, I'll do really well over time. And that's just not a place where, you know, I feel like I have the knowledge to invest there. Another area would be something like metals and mining, or something that I think is like very, very commodity dependent, where in general, when it comes to big macro factors, I think they're really, really hard to consistently get right. And for a mining company or maybe an oil and gas company, arguably the most important thing will be the price of the commodity. And one of the things that's kind of funny about the metals and mining topic is my first assignment at T. Rowe was actually covering metals and mining. And I had a lot of great experiences, got to meet a lot of awesome people and travel around the world and visit potential mines or mines that were in production. But, you know, oftentimes these were small cap companies who were trying to build one mine, didn't have any in production, and they were just always raising capital, always telling a story. And there's so little they can actually control because, you know, they can't change the actual rock. It's either going to be maybe as good as they tell you it's going to be, or a lot of times not as good. I know, you know, mining's a big industry in Canada, you know, and so I can see you, you know, likely have some experience with these companies, but that's just an area where, you know, I want to invest in companies where I think I can understand what their advantages are and their ability to repeat those and sustain those. And so these are just some areas of the market where I'm not well equipped or the businesses aren't well equipped to kind of provide what I'm looking for. And I'll definitely miss some along the way because there will be great investments in these areas, but I'm totally okay with that.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up me being in Canada and miners. Obviously, we have tons of miners, but I'm lucky I came across that amazing Charlie Munger quote where when I first started investing, where he says, a mine is basically a hole in the ground with a liar on top. And so that's kind of guided my my view on mining. So I stay away from them for the same reasons that you listed. But now that we know what you try and stay away from, can you share with the audience what you consider to be in the center of your circle of competence?
Yeah, I would say kind of like what I said earlier, I'm constantly trying to widen that circle of competence and, you know, find other industries that I understand really well. Certain industries where I have found a lot of these positive attributes, you know, I have owned a few companies that are effectively distributors, but kind of serve different industries, different end markets. But, you know, sometimes you can find an amazing distributor that has a fragmented customer base and a fragmented supplier base. And to their suppliers, they're kind of an extension of the sales force and, you know, can hopefully be very knowledgeable and a good representation of those brands. And to the customers, hopefully they can provide the right part on time, the knowledge to educate the buyer on what part they actually need and should buy. And if they do all those things well, then, you know, hopefully all their partners are really happy and they can earn kind of a nice economic return too. So sometimes there are great distributors. There can also be ones that don't have these qualities. So distributors would be one, lots of areas of business services, software, you know, so those are just a couple of areas where I have tended to find, you know, maybe more high quality businesses over time. And then there can also be other areas that, you know, maybe due to regulation or other areas can have certain moats, you know. So I've studied the railroad industry in the US or some of the waste companies. And, you know, so there are lots of different businesses and industries that can have, you know, some of these positive attributes. And then kind of like what we were saying earlier with NVR, that's one where I think, you know, maybe a lot of us would say, well, gosh, home building doesn't seem like a great industry. But then there's this one company in this cyclical industry that's kind of doing things in a different and special way. And that can be a really fertile area to find an investment as well.
Jeremy, just want to say thank you so much for joining me today. So before we say goodbye, where can the audience connect with you and learn more about Rightail Capital?
Absolutely, Kyle. I thank you. It's been a pleasure and I really enjoyed our discussion. If folks want to learn more about Rightail Capital, they can reach me in several different ways. My website is just www.rightailcapital.com. My email address is jeremy@rightailcapital.com. And I also post from time to time on LinkedIn and Twitter and other places. And really, I love to meet other folks who are similar kind of long-term, like-minded thinkers who love investing. And that can be other, you know, folks who, you know, are running their own investment businesses or people who work in some of the industries I care about. Or, you know, maybe there's someone out there who is interested in learning more and potentially investing together. And I just love to meet, you know, kind of other great people who are trying really hard to get a little bit better each day. So those are some ways that they can find me.
Okay, folks, that's it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show and I'll see you back here very soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on our episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.